I'm Amelia Phillips, and I'm the prose editor of 32 Poems, and I'm here for the weekly prose feature with poet David Wojahn on the campus of Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. Thank you for being with us, David.
I'm happy to be here.
Looking again through your 8 collections of poetry, I feel like each remains immediate and distinctly David Wojahn. I have to say, I feel like they've aged well, and the later work doesn't, for me at least, undermine the earlier. And yet I can mark several shifts in the work. Being that this is from a reader's point of view, however, the shifts I've identified may wax superficial, and that they're based on biographical details, the obsessions in subject matter, and the tendencies in form. I'm curious as to whether or not you feel as if you've reinvented yourself as a poet one or more times throughout your career the way Lowell did, or if you see yourself as honing the same kind of poem or writing installments to one long poem.
Boy, that's a good question. I think poets tend to think, or would like to think, that they, over the course of a career, remake themselves again and again. And in some respects, I think that's true. A lot of poets have made radical stylistic shifts over the course of their lifetime. James Wright being somebody who's always cited as a terrific example. But then, you know, there are other poets who I really dearly love, like Thomas Hardy, and you can't really tell a poem that he wrote in the 1860s from what he wrote in the 1920s. So it's just really hard to self-appraise that sort of thing. I do think that as the work develops over the years, and partly this is because when I first started writing, there was a kind of almost tyranny of a particular sort of subjectivist poetry, be it, you know, the surrealism that deep image poets practiced, or a kind of autobiographical poetry that was a sort of dumbing down of what people like Berryman and Lowell and Plath had done in confessional writing. And so I kind of felt that poetry was a mode of solipsistic self-expression and autobiographical regurgitation. Of course, it is to a very large degree, but if it's only that, and I think between about 1970 and maybe around 1990, in American poetry, it often felt like it was only that. It's not doing the job of poetry. And I think as I've grown older as a writer, I've remained true to those roots, because those roots of poetry as some sort of autobiographical testimony seem very important. But there are also other kind of cultural and historical and literary sources that have started to almost involuntarily but inevitably get mixed up with those original sources of my poetry. So, yeah, I think the work has changed insofar as it's been able to incorporate a little more of not just the lived life of the poet, but the cultural and historical life of the poet's time.
You often talk about obsession in relation to poetry, and in another interview you've said, subjects can be quite various, but obsessions tend not to be. In fact, they're apt to be severely limited. Readers and other interviewers have focused on a few of your touchstone subjects, rock and roll, the deaths of your parents, and your first wife, the poet Linda Hull. But it strikes me that though you still remain close to, or at very least conversant with these subjects in the later work, it never feels like you're painting over an old canvas. Though you say that obsessions tend to be severely limited, it seems that obsessions, in the case of your work, like a whirlpool, pull what comes downstream into them. And that way, obsessions don't limit the poems, but they allow the poet access to other subjects through associations that work away and back to the original obsession. But I wondered if you have any poems that you felt like were too much of a repeat of an earlier poem.
Sometimes that's the case. And I guess in that situation, or the issue of what we write about, I do really believe that very few poets have a palette that is huge. We write from a limited number of sort of holes in our lives that we feel have to be filled. And the trick often of growing as a writer is to just find new ways formally to address those obsessions. And there are all sorts of implications by what I mean formally. It can be finding ways to address your subject, your obsessive subject matter, in a way that seems to be completely unrelated to that subject matter. It can mean new formal sort of strategies that come towards that obsessive subject matter slantwise rather than directly. And in a certain respect, I really don't mind the fact that I still write about the deaths of my parents or about Linda Hall or about things that have mattered to me, both in terms of, you know, the music and the films and the poetry that continue to inspire me. It's also that if I keep returning to those things, it's because they're important. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody asked Stevens why he wrote poetry, and he said, well, you write poetry because you must. And I do think sometimes that the feeling I have in terms of repeating myself is not repeating myself in terms of revisiting the same old subjects. I mean, Philip Levine will always be a kid who worked in auto factories in Detroit, and he'll never leave that landscape behind. And that's the source of his integrity. I feel that when I'm repeating myself or imitating myself, it's usually through trying strategies within the poems, formal strategies that seem like they're the same old, or something that I've done before and probably have done better because I was discovering something rather than consciously trying to imitate myself.
So let's talk about the sonnet, and I don't think I could have interviewed you without talking about the sonnet. It's a form that seems to appear in all your collections except the first. And often they're in these rhapsodic sequences, like the rock and roll title poem, A Mystery Train, wartime photos of my father and white lanterns from late empire, as well as others, including Ochre, originally published in Blackbird. These sequences often function as a hinge in the collection, near the center or between two distinct sections. Do you generally begin work on a new collection with a sonnet sequence? Do you write the other poems around that sequence? Why does the sonnet sequence work for you in shaping a collection?
Well, that's a good question. I've never consciously decided at any point that I'm going to have to write a sonnet sequence that's going to be the trademark of a collection, but they always do seem to, for one reason or another, become very significant within the individual books. And that's been happening for 25, 30 years now. And I just think the sonnet is such a supple and such a flexible and just such an endearing form. I just love the way that you can manipulate those 140 syllables in such a no two snowflakes are alike variety of ways. You know, one of the things that will destroy one's career as a writer, I think, is if you take yourself too seriously. And my subject matter is often not just serious, but aggressively so. But you always have to have fun with writing, and there's something that's just such a delight about fooling around with the form of the sonnet. And it's always different, it's always instructive, and there's a kind of Lay's potato chips element of it that I find it very difficult to write a single sonnet and not want to find an imaginary playmate for it. And the sequences often develop because I want to add one to it, and then a third one comes, and then a fourth one comes, and, you know, sometimes as many as 25 or 30 come. Sometimes, as in the case Mystery Train years ago, I probably wrote twice as many for that sequence than actually appeared in the book. The other thing that's great about the sonnet is it's not exactly that it's a dispensable form, but it's also a form that sometimes gets generated by the very fact that you can write five and two of them will be good and you won't feel like you've wasted your time.
Why do you think it works so well with contemporary American poetry? It seems like out of all the forms, it just has survived. and is even perhaps in some ways more forceful because there's so much more leniency in what you can do with a sonnet.
The variety of what we now define as a sonnet is just, in the last 50 or 60 years, it's astonishing. Look on the one hand at how inventive Ted Berrigan was with his sonnets, or how the Dream Songs by Berryman functions, even though they're 18 lines long, as a kind of supernovel sort of sonnet sequence. It is just such an adaptable form. And one of the sources of its endurance, I think, is that, I hate to say it, but we live in a very attention-deprived sort of culture. We really do feel a certain impatience with long forms, even though I love long American 20th century epics like Patterson or Thomas McGrath's Letter to an Imaginary Friend. Remember that the origin of the word is a little song. To me, the kind of poetic equivalent of a 3-minute AM radio song from the 1960s that you can't get out of your head. So I like the compactedness of it, and yet it's very expansive within that compactedness.
In your first few collections, it seemed like you were left margin centric and you were kind of hugging that left margin, but now you drift off to that margin quite frequently. I think in a majority of the poems in World Tree, you are doing things like the staggered, jagged tercets, like Williams's Bruegel sequence, or long lines alternately followed by an indented short line, and you use drop lines as well. I just wondered how long it takes you to find the right form for your poems.
As the years go on, I find it harder and harder to write in free verse, though I love writing in free verse. And I think naturally my ear gravitates towards a line that, no matter how you parsed it, even if it were coming out as a prose poem, would start to look like blank verse. And I think a lot of the arguments I have with the forms of the poems, the various versions that I do with the poems, are trying to find a way to decide whether it looks good as pentameter, or whether I should somehow fight against the pentameter. That's often a determining force for where the poem should go. You know, sometimes you want to evoke that mighty pentameter line pretty overtly and in an in-your-face way, but sometimes you want to bury it a little bit through some sort of formal constructs. I look at people like Charles Wright or C.K. Williams, and they look often as though they're writing very long and sometimes very prosy lines, but if you scan a Williams poem, especially those characteristic ones he writes in the super long lines, they're often two lines of blank verse that have been spliced together. There's the same kind of very, very strongly iambic kind of quality to all of Charles Wright's poems. And I just like forms that are haircuts that don't look like haircuts. Often the revision process for me has first and foremost to do with trying a poem out in a whole plethora of different sorts of forms without necessarily changing the wording. And then when I find the shape that looks the most promising, then I will start to do a lot of nickel and dime revision on individual lines, on syntax, on word choice. You know, sometimes it's just the shape of the poem is the first thing that I really want to consider when I'm writing the poem.
I think you had a poem recently, was it in Agni? It was all really intensive rhymes at the end of the line.
For the last several years, I've decided that every year one of the few things I must do annually is write a poem against the NRA. And then there's the trick is to try to do it in a way that doesn't sound polemical. In the case of that poem, I have a cousin who is a gun nut but also a practicing Buddhist. And I needed to write about that because it's so fascinating, so scary to try to figure out what's going on in his character. And it ended up to be a sonnet in all A rhymes. I don't think I could have written about that subject, because it's such a loaded subject, so to speak, without having to give myself some wild formal sort of challenge that would allow me entrance to it in a way that wasn't too polemical. And it's great, too, because, you know, he'll never know about the poem and he'll never read it in this, so that's all right.
Do you ever worry about writing about those that you know and then being offended, or they feel as if they've been slighted in some way?
Sure, all the time. You feel that you're either not doing justice to the person, or that in some ways you've been indiscreet. That's always a worry, but no subject should be taboo as long as you can bring it off.
In my last year in the MFA program here at VCU, you assigned me the task of reading works that were what you called English that's not English, including Scott's poets, the 1537 Matthew's Bible, and others. I love the task, though it was challenging because it exploded some of the discursive, unmusical syntax that I thought I had to write as a contemporary poet. Do you ever find yourself falling into a rut in your syntax? And if so, how do you get out of it? Do you do it through reading? And if so, what text do you go to?
So many contemporary poems, despite what I've been saying about received forms, are composed by the sentence as much as they're composed by the line. And the line almost seems secondary to how one arranges the sentence. I find that I'm very, very interested in times or in opportunities for a particular syntax and the diction that that syntax implies to collide with the very, very different diction and the syntax that that diction implies. I love what you can do in a poem that you can't do in a lot of other forms of discourse. It's move very, very quickly from highfalutin rhetorical language to very, very vernacular language. And it's not so much the issue of syntax is so connected to with the issue of diction. You almost can't discern the difference between the two of them. And so I like to play with those sorts of collisions, dictional collisions, which turn into then rhythmic collisions. And they also often give me an opportunity to do what I like to do a lot, is steal, quote, and sample from other poets, from music. And when you're in that groove, when you're in that zone where there's a lot of possibility for associational and syntactical variety, you can end up throwing a lot of things that you didn't know you were going to throw in. It's also a question, I think, of sampling.
Many poets who encounter the language of religious rites and rituals at a young age often cite those sources as being influential in their choice to become a poet. If I remember correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, you were raised in the Anglican Episcopal Church. When I approach a poem like your poem Ode to Black Six and World Tree, I see syntactical moves like from the Book of Common Prayer, and I just thought I would read a quick section from that poem, the opening. To your veins we've clogged with butter, we give thanks. To your brain tumor withering the use of your left side. To Alzheimer's befuddling your stumble through the labyrinth. Indifferent now to females and estrus, to positive reinforcement, merci. And likewise, looking back, I can't help but think about your poem Stammer from the Falling Hour, in which, among other things, the speaker is going through speech therapy with exercises of ah, 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 ee, 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 and Ruth rang Randy rarely. These exercises, because of their repetition, seem almost liturgical as well. Could you speak a little bit more about your early interactions with language and how conscious you are about their influence on your writing today?
The Book of Common Prayer, which, you know, Thomas Cranmer composed in the 1530s, has some of the most gorgeous language in English. And since going to old-style Anglican services when I was a kid and hearing that sort of language was maybe my first encounter with literary language, with language that could be different from spoken language, at least in a serious way that wasn't like nursery rhymes. The inventiveness with the language that Cranmer put into those texts, and they're wonderful texts too, because
they're practical as well as lyrical. That there are whole passages from it that I know I'm not even consciously aping when I write a poem, just because they were such an early and essential part of my poetic DNA. You know, like in the communion service, there's this line about being so unworthy through our manifold sins and wickedness as to gather the crumbs from under thy table. I remember just loving that line above almost anything I'd ever heard in English. And I think it's just because it's such a strange image, but it's made even stranger just because of that crazy Jamesian periodic sentence that introduces it. So I think I came very early on into what is probably a condition that's pretty good for a poet, is I have a hard time making a distinction between whether something engages me poetically because of its imagery or simply because of its sound. I see the two as coming always in tandem in these weird entwinings. And an image like that from the communion service is a really, really good example of it. And I think it kind of imprinted me in that respect. I was an altar boy for a long time, and I even thought that maybe I'd be an Episcopal priest. But then I was about 16 and became a Quaker. So I entered into a long period where there wasn't that much interesting language in my religious experience. No offense to the Quakers.
You were talking a few minutes ago and a couple questions back about taking language from other sources, and looking through World Tree, I see where you're borrowing song lyrics from Dylan's Visions of Johanna and the Talking Heads' Once in a Lifetime. Elsewhere, you're grabbing from Walden, a former student, Alan Dugan, etc. I can't help but think of Coca-Cola warning Andy Warhol about using Coke as a title for his film. But of course, poets don't have the same kind of visibility as an artist like Andy Warhol. But I wondered if you've ever been tapped on the shoulder and been told, don't use that in a poem.
No, I haven't. And I think one of the issues at stake now is that copyright law is so complex, and there are so many ways of interpreting it, that I think it's gotten to be a little bit creepy. My friend Mary Ruffel published a wonderful book of essays called Madness, Rack, and Honey last year. And there's a beautiful essay she had to completely leave out because it stole two or three lines from Leonard Cohen. And the people who are controlling the rights to Cohen's lyrics were asking so much money for it, to have done it would have cost more than printing the entire book. A lot of people play hardball with borrowings, but the sad thing is that the whole tradition of English literature is a kind of borrowing and thievery and reshaping. That's what The Wasteland is made of. And, you know, one of the contemporary poets I ever most admire, David Ferry, who's 89 years old now, has a poem in his new book that is this radical but absolutely faithful borrowing from Thomas Wyatt's They Flee From Me. You know, the fact that a poet who is 88 years old can borrow and steal and make his own a poem by a jilted courtier from 500 years ago, it's just, it's an amazing thing to me. The whole tradition of the way the blues have evolved in the 20th century to so many wonderful permutations is just another example of just how tradition lives in a very, very vital way. And so many of the utterances that we make as poets, as musicians, and you're always reinterpreting the atmosphere of earlier cultures that have influenced you and have been important to you. I think it's very, very dangerous when someone who doesn't have an understanding of how art functions in that way gets in the way of the process in order simply to make money. We're not talking about fair use then. We're talking about something very much akin to suppression. It's Orwellian.
Well, with the 25-section long poem, a sonnet sequence, Ochre and World Tree, you pair each section with an image. Most of them are, you know, actual images that you wrote about, but then there's a few in the sequence that were actually created after the poems were written based on the poems.
Yeah.
When I worked for Blackbird, we helped make some of those images. The three in the poem that are created after the fact of the poem are the one of Dick Cheney in a gas mask, the Scrabble board, and the photo of twin beds, the photo that Davy took when Johnny and I were asleep section.
Yeah.
Why situate these poems in ekphrasis? How does it complicate or inform the rest of the long poem?
Again, it's a question of if one is establishing a kind of fidelity so that you're writing a series of ekphrastic poems and you feel that the ekphrasis has to be of something that you're actually describing, you're limiting a lot of your imaginative choices. Most of the images in that series are real photographs or real images that I am trying to riff on or describe. But there are also a few images in there that could have existed. And so the poem sort of had to precede the reconstruction of that thing had it existed. That sequence of poems is trying to juxtapose Paleolithic art with anonymous 19th century photographs and with certain political statements that I want to make. And so more and more as the sequence goes on, it tries to mine, go from memory in a big cultural way to memory in a smaller and more personal way. The more recent ones from my own past were harder to create sometimes than the ones from Chauvet Cave. So, yeah, so it was very fun to write a poem about an image that didn't exist and then later on create the image literally. But they're not too far from reality. In the case of Cheney, and you see this in Jane Mayer's wonderful book, or Savage book about the War on Terror, The Dark Side, Cheney didn't go anywhere for several years after 9/11. Without a briefcase with his papers and a briefcase with a hazmat suit. I think it just indicates the level of monstrous paranoia that so motivated Cheney, especially, and all of his cohorts in the Bush administration. And, you know, so he did have the gas mask. We just don't have any photographs of the gas mask. So in some ways, I feel like I'm doing the reality a favor by photoshopping a version of Dick Cheney with a gas mask.
Well, I mean, you've used plenty of visual elements elsewhere in your poems, including Crayola from Spirit Cabinet. You have the speech bubbles as if it's almost like a comic book. And then you started in that same collection doing these poems that are one-line stanzas separated by breaks that are diamonds or leaves or whatever. And I'm thinking about an Ochre as well. One of the sections in particular is the Scrabble poem, in which on the left-hand margin you have quixotic, and each letter as it goes down has the amount that would get in Scrabble points. So it's like Q, 10, etc. Because you're balancing visuals and sonics often in your poems, I wondered, when you read aloud the poems, do you feel like you risk losing some of what the poem's doing to a reading audience, or is that the case with all poems?
I think that's the case with all poems. And the example you're citing is sonnets that have an asterisk that is just there to simultaneously do something that's almost paradoxical. One, make the reader pay more attention to the individual lines, and two, make the reader not be aware, at least right away, that what he or she is reading is a sonnet. So in some ways it's an attempt to help to reinvigorate the essential musicality of the sonnet that we tend a lot of the time to take for granted. I think if you read poetry often enough, you open up a page and you see that a poem is 37 lines long, and if, like me, you don't particularly like Sestinas, your first impulse is to either not read the poem or say, show me what you can do. So it's, again, a kind of thing of, you want a haircut that doesn't look like a haircut. I love Sistinas that don't allow me to know they're Sistinas until I'm pretty much finished with them. And ditto with sonnets, some of the time.
You've confided that you're a synesthete. And can you tell us what that exactly means in terms of perception for you and how it's affected your poetry?
Like a lot of poets, I'm probably a synesthete and I'm probably a little dyslexic. For a long time, when I would finally get a draft of a poem, for example, I would use an ivory-colored paper that's about 25 weight that was really expensive to get that final draft on there, because I wanted the poems to have a particular look and smell and even a kind of, you know, implied taste that made me feel like the poem not just was finished, but it was my poem that was finished, because I had such strange and probably dysfunctional ways of looking at that poem. Rimbaud was very, very right in that vowel sonnet, in understanding that, you know, for poets especially, it's the components of language are something that are not just visual, but address simultaneously all of the senses together, and never in a way that makes a lot of associative sense. They intermingle, they interact. And one reason I'm interested in languages like Sumerian, where some of the images are visual ones, some of them are syllabic ones. I think a lot of times what I try to do in poetry is to get back to that sort of language, where we're painting with literal word pictures as well as symbolic concepts and syllabic concepts. And the poem is this great sort of field, I think, because all of those things can coexist at once. But we're trained not to read like that. And we're trained increasingly to read for information. A really good example of that is, you know, all of the weird contractions that people use in text messaging. And I don't think they're aware while they're using it that they're radically reshaping the language and making the language fundamentally strange. And the possibilities of that linguistically or poetically are really, really interesting. And they're just focusing on a task and not on the way that language is being subtly but very radically reshaped.
Your work Collection to Collection seems to be increasingly conversant with other poets. I went through WorldTree and I started listing off all the poets that you either address or mention blatantly in the poems. And I'm sure there's plenty of others that are a little bit more buried. But I'm seeing Thoreau and Hikmet and Rimbaud and Linda Hull, W.S. Graham, William Carlos Williams, Alida Shirley, Tomas Tranströmer, Frank O'Hara, George Oppen, Rilke, Berryman, John Anderson, Alan Dugan, Miwosh, Vallejo, and others. Can you speak a little bit about what you feel is the obligation that poets have to be conversant with other work and other poets? Or is it simply impossible not to be in conversation?
I think it's impossible not to be. And the notion of thieving from one's sources is not necessarily, to my mind, an act of robbery as much as it's an act of homage. You know, one of my favorite albums is an album of rock and roll surrealist Robin Hitchcock called Robin Sings. And what Hitchcock and his band attempt to do in that album is recreate note for note Dylan and the band's 1966 Albert Hall concert, doing it to the point where there's that moment right before Like a Rolling Stone where they have somebody in the audience say, Judas, and Hitchcock's, you know, does the thing where he says, I don't believe you, you're a liar. And Robin Hitchcock's a great singer, but he's not Dylan. Right? He's not doing the incredible sorts of absolutely new thing that Dylan was doing with the band at that concert. But it seems an act of incredible kind of homage to try to imitate it in that way. And in the liner notes of that album, Hitchcock basically says that I've listened to that album and listened to those songs for so long that part of me doesn't remember that I didn't write them. And he doesn't say that from a stance, I think, of egotism, as much as if you live with the writers and singers and the books and the movies that you love, they're at a certain point so much a part of your consciousness that if you don't rely on them, if you don't quote from them, you're almost doing an injustice to that. I don't think it's egotistical to say that I've read, say, Vallejo's Black Stone on a White Stone so often for so many years that sometimes I forget the fact that I didn't write it. I think it's more that what you do as a poet over the years is, you know, you have this poetic playlist that has become so entwined in your synapses and your DNA that, yeah, those poems are yours. I am so grateful that I've had the opportunity over the years to get to that point that I want to celebrate that and do homage to that by throwing those quotes in. So I don't think they're opportunistic. I think they're, in a certain sense, acknowledging the fact that I'm a completely derivative poet, and I'm happy to be a completely derivative poet, and I'm happy to celebrate those people whose work has meant a lot to me. And I look at that list that you just gave me, and it's a pretty long list, but I think it's probably only about a half as long as it really should be.
Well, I mean, in some respects, all language is derivative, and most of us aren't creating new words in our poems, so it seems only natural that the phrases that are coming in, even some of the modes of syntax or expression or approach to their subjects would come into your own work.
Yeah, it's just that you reuse things and make them your own. You translate them into your own vernacular, and they remain absolutely the property of those people that you have borrowed from, but they're your property too. And, you know, I do think poetry, without getting all sentimental about it, is a transactional endeavor in which the great democracy of poetry has to do with the fact that you assume that your reader can understand a poem in the same way that you understand the poems that you've read and the poems that you write, and that there's a quality about reading poems, or more specifically, about rereading poems, that despite the loneliness of the poetic vocation, is deeply, deeply communal. Any community that's a real community has a set of traditions. And I just like to remind, I guess, my readers that in terms of poetry, no matter how eccentric my own poetry is, it is part of a continuity in a community.
It also strikes me that in the same way that rereading poems by your favorite poets can make those poems feel like yours, reading your own poems, again, they feel somewhat distant or strange. I mean, at least in the case of when I'm writing my own poems, yeah. Do you ever feel that way?
Well, if you've written as many poems as I have now, which is not a huge number, but the number's getting up there, sometimes I'll look in a book and completely forget that I wrote a poem. And you have a choice then of looking at that poem and saying, boy, that is a piece of shit. I should never remember again that I wrote it. Or saying, hey, that's kind of far out. I'd forgotten that I wrote that, and it's not half bad. Poems are not meant to be read, they're meant to be reread.
I believe you did a translation of some Anglo-Saxon work for an anthology, is that correct?
Yeah, it's called The Word Exchange. And, uh-huh. And you know, there are great things in it, like, you know, Chinese translation of The Seafarer and a poem by David Ferry called The Sacrifice of Isaac that I think are wonderful. So I did a couple translations from the Exeter Book of Riddles, mm-hmm. which are, again, very, very strange sorts of literary endeavors that I really find fascinating.
Have you ever done any other translation work?
You know, I used to translate a little bit from the Spanish, but my Spanish isn't as good as I would like it to be to really feel like I could be a legitimate Spanish translator. I would love to do more.
Every now and then I hear some discussion about literary lineages. Being a student of yours, your teacher would be like my literary grandfather or something.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a bullshit notion, or do you think there is something to it, like there's some way to inherit?
You know, when you put it in familial terms, it's kind of interesting, because if you're a parent, what you want for your children is to have a good life, but you ideally don't want them to be given the notion that what you do, they should do. You know, it's not like we're in medieval guilds where if you're a tinker, your son has to be a tinker. There is that element in poetry and any art form of people in a multi-generational way passing down your expertise as an artist. On the other hand, though, if you're going to be a teacher who is in any way worth the definition of being a teacher, you don't want to replicate yourself. You have to do something that is really hard and analytical and sort of help them to find out what sort of poem they must write and encourage them in that sort of poem. And always be aware that that sort of poem is not necessarily going to be the sort of poem that you want to write. So it's a question of looking at every student's work diagnostically and trying to see that Platonic ideal of what kind of poem the student really feels more than anything else compelled to write and help that student along the way. That's the kind of relationship that a mentor should have to a mentee, and it is a kind of parental relationship in that respect.
Were there any poets you idolized early on that you later came to realize weren't exactly A1?
Boy, that's a tough one. The thing that's lovely when you're a young poet is you want to read everything. Or at least when I was growing up, that was the case, because there were so many interesting and competing schools in American poetry in the 60s and 70s, that then became a little more uniform, the period style. I have found poets that I loved early on that I understand they're deeply flawed. I mentioned James Wright earlier, and was one of the first poets I discovered. And I know that there are problems in Wright's work that are much more easy for me to identify now that I don't idealize him in that way. And yeah, there were poets that I loved in those days, like, for example, James Tate. And I still think James Tate is a fabulous writer, but there's nothing that I can